All right, this is Bio 241, and it is December 1st. We're in the respiratory chapter, beginning of the respiratory chapter. We might finish that up today. Sign-in sheet is right here. Go ahead, sign in, pass it around, and pass it to the front, please. I don't know when our final is, but it's not next week. It's probably the week after. But it's in the syllabus correctly, as far as I know. The 15th. Yes, December 15th. Okay, so that's good. So we got today and Thursday and then Tuesday next week, and that's it for the class. All right, so there's one thing that you should be paying attention to with your lab instructors, and that is to make sure that they know what your correct lab scores are, so that when I get them, I can calculate your final grades. All right, so they're supposed to be around during finals week even sometime to go over their grades to make sure that they're correct. Because the last thing anybody wants to do is Christmas Eve recalculate a bunch of grades because the scores are wrong, right? So that's kind of up to you to make sure that it's calculated correctly. All right, you got plenty of time to talk with the lab instructors. All right, so we were talking about the respiratory system. I don't know if any of you went back to your anatomy and reviewed the respiratory tract at all, the upper and lower respiratory tract. But there's one special place in the lungs that we're focusing on in physiology, and it is where gas exchanges. And so what part of the respiratory system do respiratory gases exchange with the air and the blood? Not tissue spaces and blood, but air and blood. That would be the alveoli. That's right. So the alveoli are surrounded with a network of capillaries and also a network of special proteins, which you don't have a picture of in your physiology book, but your anatomy book had a really good picture. Had a network of these blue fibers around each alveolus. And what kind of proteins are those? They're protein fibers, proteinaceous fiber. What kind of fibers did you learn about in anatomy? You learned about collagen that don't stretch. They're really strong fibers. Elastic fibers. They stretch pretty easily, and then when you let go, what happens to them? They go back to their original position. All right, and then you learned about reticular fibers. They aren't very strong. They don't stretch, and they're easy to damage. All right, but the fibers that are around the alveolus are elastic fibers. All right, so I do want you to be aware of elastic fibers. There's an extensive network of elastic fibers around every alveolus. Okay, and I'm going to talk about those. All right, so I think we were talking about surface area considerations last time. All right, I think I measured the door. What was the surface area of that pedestrian door over there? Anybody remember?
1 meter.
Yeah, it was 1 meter wide by exactly 2 meters tall, right? So it's 2 square meters. So when I say surface area, you should automatically be thinking about what?
Doorway.
A doorway for exchange. The bigger the surface area, what happens to exchange? Yeah, there's more exchange. So they are directly related. Familiar with that term? If two things are directly related to each other, if one goes up, the other automatically goes up, right? So exchange goes as the surface area. Okay, so what about the surface area of the lungs? If we were to take each of those little tiny microscopic alveoli and peel it like a grape and lay that skin down on a table, okay, and then peel the next one and lay it flat on a table, putting it right next to each other, kind of like a puzzle, just fitting all the alveoli so that they're flat and not spherical, all right, then what would be the surface area for exchange in the lungs? From air on one side of the alveoli to blood that's on the other side of an alveolus, okay? And it's a huge surface area because there's about 300 million alveoli. So you'd be really busy almost for the rest of your life, right, peeling all those alveoli, putting them down on the table. But it would turn out to be about 70 square meters, which is the size of half of a tennis court. So that's a huge surface area. So that's why we can do all the things that we do, because there's a huge doorway that allows oxygen to get into our bodies. And the nice thing is that surface area is folded up inside our thoracic cavity so that it occupies a much smaller space, which is really nice, because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as a tennis court. I'd be knocking people over right now. Okay, so that's the surface area for exchange, about half a tennis court. So here we have an illustration of an alveolus. All right, so here is air, and let's look at some cell types that make up an alveolus. Don't forget, we got about 300 million of these. The cell that makes up the wall of an alveolus is an epithelium. Now, what kind of epithelium does that remind you of? I see a nucleus right here, so this cell goes to over here, and then it goes over to here someplace. All right. Remember, an epithelium does what? Covers the surface or lines a cavity. This one is lining this cavity right here. And how do we talk about epithelium or epithelia? By two criteria. What are the two criteria that we classify epithelium as? Shape. I heard shape. I heard shape someplace. Yeah? What kind of shape is this cell right here? It's squamous, which means it's thin. It's like a pancake. All right? And also by number of layers. So this is a nice, do you believe me, a nice simple squamous epithelium. And all simple squamous epithelium are specialized for what kind of function? Exchange, because diffusion can only work across very thin spaces, and this cell is very, very thin. Okay, we also talked about capillaries. So here's a capillary. I see some red blood cells in there. The endothelium, which is an epithelium that lines a blood vessel, and in particular this capillary right here, is also classified as what kind of epithelium? How many cells? Well, what's the shape of this cell right here? Is it columnar, cuboidal, or squamous? It's squamous. And how about the layers? Is it simple or stratified? It's simple. So again, it's a simple stratified epithelium specialized for exchange, which means it's really, really thin. So oxygen and carbon dioxide can diffuse across this space easily because that space is very thin, even including this basement membrane right here, which is also thin. It's drawn a little bit out of scale. Okay, it looks a little thick to my eye right here. All right, so exchange can take place between air in an alveolus and plasma or red blood cells in a capillary because the walls of these structures are extremely thin. And they're not stratified. Nothing preventing the diffusion of those gases. All right, so that's an important thing to consider. So sometimes we consider a respiratory membrane. The respiratory membrane is composed of, first, the wall of the alveolus, which is what, thick or thin? Thin. The basement membrane, or interstitial space, and again, that's thin. That's the second part. And the third part is the wall of the capillary. Those are the things, those are the structures that molecules actually have to diffuse through to get from one compartment to the other. So we consider that the respiratory membrane. Okay. All right, so let's look in a little bit more detail in the cells that we find inside an alveolus. We see the cells that make up the wall. Those are what we call the alveolar type 1 cells. All right, they're just squamous cells. And then we see an alveolar type 2 cell right here. And this alveolar type 2 cell, it performs a very special function, and it relates to water. So if you think of water, is water a slippery substance or is it a sticky substance? Okay. Some of you might have taken some classes with me already. I heard some say that it is slippery, but I heard more people say that it's actually sticky, and I'm really glad that you said that, that it is actually very sticky. It acts like glue. Now, why does water act like glue? Because it has what kind of bonds? What kind of bonds? It has a bunch of hydrogen bonds, right? So water molecules like to get together. Oxygen of one molecule likes to be attracted to the hydrogen of another water molecule. So even though these hydrogen bonds are very weak, when you're talking about trillions and trillions and trillions of these hydrogen bonds in water, water really is more like a crystal than a fluid because the water molecules like to stick together. And probably you've been out in the woods hiking someplace and you've actually seen some animals that walk right on the surface of water because the water is so sticky it doesn't like to part. They don't go kaplunk when they step on a stream or a pond or a puddle or something. What kind of animals am I thinking about that can actually walk right on the surface of water without falling in? okay, like insects, like water spiders and things like that, okay, because the surface tension is holding those water molecules together and the little insect can't fall in. So maybe we should do a real quick experiment, all right, looking at hydrogen bonds that produce that phenomena called surface tension. All right, surface tension is just the sticky properties of water. So guess what I have right here? A couple transparencies. And if I put them together like this, and they're just nice and dry right now, if I put them together and I hold on to one and I drop the other one, what's going to happen to the one that I let go of? It's going to slide down. It's going to drop, and you got to catch it. Okay? Ah, really good, right? So that's really easy process. Now let's put some glue on there. Where can I go for glue? Yeah, just this water right here. I'll make a mess. Let's try this one. Ah, good. All right, so did I squirt anybody? Hopefully not. All right, so there I got just some water on there, right? Put these two acetates together, and indeed they are together. And again, we'll do the same experiment. I'll hold on to one, and I'll let go of the other one. Now is it going to fall down?
No.
It's just going to drip. Sorry about that. Okay? And even if I shake it, look, it doesn't fall down. I'm just am I holding on just to one?
Yeah.
Yes. All right, now how about if somebody pulls on the other one, just straight down, pull on the other one. Amazing how much tension there was there. Did that kind of surprise you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so this water acts like glue, and that's really important function in certain parts of the respiratory system, but it has to be defeated in other parts of the respiratory system. So since we're considering this alveolus right here, all right, so you could actually... We could do that little experiment again, but I want to make sure I'm not pulling on the same one. All right, try it again. Pull on that one right there. Oh, it's beginning to slip a little bit. Okay, but still a lot of surface tension. All right, so there is water in this alveolus right here. And don't forget, water is sticky. It has that property of surface tension, so that if this alveolus were to collapse, and indeed it does because of all those elastic fibers around an alveolus right here, right? If there's just water in here, if these walls approximated and touches each other, that surface tension would glue the alveolus in what kind of shape? It would just flatten the alveolus out. And when you tried to breathe, it wouldn't inflate because the walls would be glued together. All right. So there's a special cell right here called the alveolar type 2 cell that secretes a compound pretty much like a soap or a detergent, and it disrupts the surface tension, makes water very slippery, right? And so now this alveolus can inflate and it can deflate, and even if the walls touch each other, it can go back and inflate again. So surface tension allows alveoli to inflate. That's really important. As a matter of fact, in individuals that aren't producing surfactant, they can't breathe. Why can't they breathe? Because that alveolus doesn't inflate, right? The walls are glued together. So don't forget about surfactant produced by these alveolar type 2 cells. The third kind of cell we see right here are macrophages. They're shapeshifters. They're crawling around inside this alveolus and all through our respiratory passageways looking for things that don't belong in your lungs. Because things pass through, right, our nasal cavity and our trachea and bronchi, even though it's lined with mucus that's supposed to trap all that debris that's going into our lungs, bacteria and viruses, still a lot of particles end up in an alveolus, and it's the job of this macrophage to recognize them and kill them, and maybe even bring them into your body so that they can be recognized by higher functioning immunological cells that will develop a immune response to those particular pathogens. Okay, so those are the cells of the alveolus and something about an alveolus. Okay, air can even pass from one alveolus to another via pores that you have between the walls of the alveoli. Okay, you're familiar with the conducting zone of air, the respiratory passageways from anatomy, right, starting with the larynx. The conducting zone pretty much is typified by having a lot of cartilage, so that these airway passages cannot compress. They can't constrict, because if they were to compress like the esophagus, then of course you wouldn't be able to breathe in or out. All right, so you're familiar with that kind of stuff. The thoracic cavity, its inferior margin is defined by the diaphragm, right, which is a muscle. It's a dome-shaped muscle, a skeletal muscle, which you can control with just voluntarily control. Thorax contains, of course, the heart, large blood vessels, the trachea, esophagus, thymus, and the lungs. And below the diaphragm is the abdominal pelvic cavity. There's really nothing separating the abdominal cavity from the pelvic cavity, so we put them together, right? And that contains all your digestive and reproductive organs, right? So, but we're going to consider the thoracic cavity. So here is a nice transverse section of the thoracic cavity, and I see the lungs right here. And more importantly, I see the serous membrane that is surrounding the lungs. So when I say serous membrane, what kind of images does that conjure in your mind? Contrast it with another kind of membrane. A serous membrane lines what kind of cavity? That is not open to the outside world, as opposed to a mucous membrane, which lines a cavity that is open to the outside world. So for instance, this trachea right here is lined with a mucous membrane because it's open to the outside world, but the pleural membrane is a serous membrane because it just lines the pleural cavity. And the serous membrane is a little bit more complicated than a mucous membrane because how many parts does it have? Okay, that's two is pretty good, but it's actually, think of it in terms of three spaces. All right, so there's the part of the pleural membrane that lines the surface of the lung tissue itself. We call that the visceral pleura. And it is continuous, we can see continuing around, and then eventually it lines the thoracic cavity, the wall of the thorax. It's actually the same kind of tissue, but it's on a different structure. It's no longer touching the lung, it's touching the body wall, so we call that the parietal pleura. So we have the visceral and parietal pleural membranes, and the third part then is the space that is separating them filled with serous fluid. So there's a fluid separating these two membranes. So that's how we typically consider any kind of serous membrane. Okay. So the intrapleural space is filled with that serous fluid right there. Okay, let me see if I got another picture. Well, I want to say something about that serous fluid in the pleural space. Notice that the lungs follow very closely the shape of the thoracic cavity, right? It's like glued to the wall of the thorax, right? And that's due to that serous fluid. Now, we said in an alveolus, we defeat surface tension by those type 2 cells secreting what kind of compound? Surfactant, right? So that allows the walls of the alveolus to slip apart and inflate. Well, the serous fluid in this intrapleural space right here has no surfactant. So what is it acting like? What's it acting like? Just think of these two transparencies. Oh, I can't even get them off the table now. They're what? They're glued together just due to water. Wow, they're really glued together now, really. Maybe I'm pulling on the same piece of paper. Okay. I can't tell. They're glued together. All right, so that serous fluid kind of glues the wall of the lung to the wall of the thorax. All right, so that's one thing that is attaching it. So when we change the volume of the thorax, guess what we're actually doing? We're pulling on the surface of the lungs and maybe inflating the lungs when we do that. We expand the lungs because of surface tension of the serous fluid right here. All right, so let's talk some more about physical aspects of ventilation. Along with that serous fluid, all right, air moves, yeah.
What causes pleural effusion?
Pleural effusion. Okay, I'm not thinking about effusion. You have to define what effusion is.
My dad has a bypass.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, I think effusion doesn't have anything to do with the pleural space. I think it has to do with the alveoli actually filling up with fluid. But you know what? I'm going to have to do a little search and make sure if I'm actually sure with that information, okay? And maybe effusion could be either one of those spaces. And then you have, if it's one but not the other, then it's probably treated a little bit differently. Plural effusion. Well, for instance, if it is, let me just go back. If it is, you know, now I'm beginning to remember that plural effusion is just when this intrapleural space fills up with fluid, okay? And not the alveoli themselves, that would be more like a pneumonia, okay? So if this intrapleural space fills up with fluid, then of course, what happens to the lungs themselves? They get compressed, all right? So they can't expand in order for air to get in your lungs. And so that means you can't breathe very well. So you're really in miserable shape when that happens. You feel terrible because you can't breathe. Feel like you're out of breath. Even though you're breathing, air doesn't really move in and out of your lungs. So you want to find the cause of that. I think that's a common occurrence. That's just one of the side effects of any kind of surgery. Okay. And, oh, of course, if you do, we're actually going to talk about this a little bit later. Okay. You might want to find the cause for that. If it's an infection, then of course you need to treat the infection. All right, but a lot of times what can happen, you can just insert a hypodermic needle into that space and just aspirate the fluid out, and that will almost immediately restore ventilatory function to the patient. Okay, but you don't want to go all the way through into the lung. You just need to get into that space, so I suppose you need to do a little ultrasound so you can guide where that needle goes. Right, unless somebody has a nice touch and feel to get right into that space and remove the fluid, and then the lungs can inflate and you feel tremendously better right away. Okay, so that probably would be a complication of any kind of thoracic surgery. Is that what you were talking about, some kind of thoracic surgery? Yeah. So that's just an inflammatory process of the pleural membrane, which could just be due to trauma when you do surgery, or it could be due to infection. Okay. All right, so air is going to, of course, move in and out of your lungs. What space of your lungs? These spaces right here, we're talking about the alveoli, right? All right, and a fluid can be a gas like air, or a fluid could be a liquid like blood, and a fluid is going to move only due to what kind of circumstance? How does blood move from one place to another? In order to get fluid to move, what has to happen? Yeah, pressure difference, right? And the same thing for air. Air is going to move in and out of your lungs if there is a pressure difference, and air is going to move from high pressure to low pressure, right? So we're going to look at some of these pressure changes. We're also going to consider some other properties of the lung, and that is the compliance of the lung. Compliance means that if pressure changes in the lungs, that's going to change the shape of the lungs. All right, so what do you think about the compliance of this room right here? If we change the pressure inside this room, is the shape of this room going to change at all? No, because the room has no compliance. It's just made of this concrete, right? We could double the pressure inside this room if we closed all the doors and hooked up a compressor, right? But the shape of this building is not going to change. It has zero compliance. Unlike your lungs, small changes in pressure will mean big changes in volume because your lungs are very compliant. Lungs are also very elastic, which means that once a lung inflates, if you release that pressure, what's going to happen to a lung? It's going to go back to its original shape, right? It's going to squeeze down because of all those elastic proteins around the alveoli, right? And surface tension plays an important role of being able to inflate those alveoli easily, right? So those are all things that we're going to look at. All right, so we can move air in and out of our lungs by changing the shape of the thoracic cavity, right? And so we can expand and contract the thoracic cavity, and because the lungs are attached to the wall of the thorax, that's going to change the shape of the lungs, right? Okay, so that as we mentioned, that intrapleural space right here contains that sticky fluid, which attaches the surface of the lung to the wall of the thorax. So during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure, so that means that that's the pressure inside the alveoli, it's the pressure inside the lungs, is about -3 millimeters of mercury. Now what is the pressure of the air? Just typically, it varies from day to day. But in terms of millimeters of mercury, what's the pressure? All right, it's about that's pretty dim, 760 millimeters of mercury. And the pressure inside our lungs, okay, when we inspire is about 757 millimeters of mercury, right? So that's where we come up with that -3. We subtract one from the other. So if this is the air, right? This is the pulmonary pressure right here. It's lower, so which way is air going to flow? From the air into the lungs, right? So now we got to figure out how do we get that pressure lower inside the lungs. Okay. So that's during inspiration. During expiration, right, the intrapulmonary pressure increases above atmospheric pressure by about 3 millimeters of mercury, and that causes air to leave our lungs. And that positive transmural pressure, that's the difference between the intrapulmonary and intrapleural pressure, keeps the lungs inflated all the time. So that's what this little table shows right here. Regardless if it's inspiration or expiration, if we look at the transpulmonary pressure by subtracting intrapleural from intrapulmonary, if we have -3, -6, we're left with 3 millimeters of mercury. So that keeps the lungs attached to the thoracic wall. And the same thing for expiration, right? If we have 3 millimeters of mercury and subtract a -3, right, we still have a positive pressure that's causing the lungs to stay inflated. All right, so notice that these pressures indicate a pressure measurement in millimeters of mercury below or above atmospheric pressure, right, which is 760 millimeters of mercury. All right, so why does this happen? Because of something that you should be familiar with called Boyle's Law. And I don't know if you talk about Boyle's Law in lab, okay? Do you guys talk about Boyle's Law in lab? I'm not sure if you do, so we should probably go over it. All right, Boyle's Law is pretty nice and simple. It only has two variables. It has pressure of a fluid and the volume that fluid is contained in, right? Pressure and volume, only these two variables right here. And how are they related to each other? So I could write this on the board. Maybe I'll try to find a little bit darker marker. All right, we got pressure is equal to what? 1 over volume. That's what we have right there, right? So what is this relationship with pressure and volume? Are they directly related? No, they are just inversely related. So if the volume goes up, what happens to pressure? Goes down. If the pressure goes up, what happens to volume? Okay, it goes the opposite way. All right, so that is Boyle's Law. All right, so that implies that changes in the intrapulmonary pressure occur as a result of changes in lung volume. So they're related to each other, but in an inverse way. Pressure of a gas is inversely proportional to volume, right? That's basically Boyle's Law. Increase in lung volume decreases the intrapulmonary pressure, right? So as the lung increases, intrapulmonary pressure decreases below atmospheric pressure. So which way does air move in the lungs when the lung volume increases? So if lung volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases, and when pressure decreases, which way does air flow? From high to low in your lungs, and air flows into your lungs. Okay. And a decrease in lung volume raises intrapulmonary pressure, causing expiration, right? So when your lung volume decreases, all right, I guess you could think of a balloon. If you have a balloon and you squeeze down on it, what happens to the volume? Well, if you have a balloon filled with air and you squeeze down on it, what happens to the volume? The volume decreases, but what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it decrease too? No, because of Boyle's Law goes the other way, the pressure increases. Okay. So as the lung volume decreases, the intrapulmonary pressure increases. So again, air will flow from high pressure to low. It will flow from high inside your lungs out into the atmosphere, which is relatively low pressure. Okay. So let's do just a little quick little example right here. So here we have a lung, all right? And the glass represents your thoracic cavity, but since it's glass, it's not going to change. But we can change the volume of the thoracic cavity because we have what is this rubber thing right here representing? That's the diaphragm. And normally the diaphragm is dome-shaped, right? So I'm going to push up into the thoracic cavity, and Here we got a little trachea, the hole and the little stopper right there. And the balloons represent? Okay, and the blue one represents the, which one? The right or left one? I'm kidding, right? They're the same color. Okay, that's good. All right, so right and left doesn't matter so much. So we can increase the volume, right? We can increase the volume of this jar by what? Pulling down on the diaphragm. That's going to increase the volume. What's going to happen to the pressure inside there? If we increase, Boyle's law says the pressure is going to decrease, all right? And if there's low pressure inside the thoracic cavity and it's connected to the outside world, what's going to happen to the balloons? All right, if we decrease the pressure in those balloons by increasing the volume, they should inflate. And when we decrease the volume by letting the diaphragm go up to its original position like that, all right, we increase the pressure inside here, and that's going to force air out of the lungs, right? So this is a really nice, simple model of how people inflate and deflate their lungs. But don't forget, those alveoli also are surrounded with what kind of protein fibers?
Elastic.
So when they're inflated, if we just let go, those elastic fibers are going to cause, right, the collapse of those alveoli, and that will help expel air. All right, so we could do another quick experiment right here. I got a couple containers which can model what an alveolus is like. I got this paper bag on the way home the other day before Thanksgiving. Okay, so let's presume that this is an alveolus right here. And what does an alveolus do? It fills up with air. Okay, so let's fill this alveolus up with air. All right. And what I want you to do, we're going to compare these two different alveoli, and you got to tell me which one is a better model of how an alveolus really functions inside your lungs if it's healthy. All right, and then you could tell me which one would be a good example with a diseased alveolus. All right, so here we have one right here. I'll fill it up with air. Oh, I didn't check this out ahead of time. Hopefully there's no hole in there. Okay, so I got a bunch of air in this alveolus right here. Now, does this paper bag have any elastic properties?
No.
So if I let go and let the air escape, what's going to happen to the shape of this alveolus? Is it going to collapse? No. It may just stay right there, right? So I make sure that the airway is open and I let go. And indeed, the airway is open, right? Because there's no elastic property of that alveolus, air is trapped in the lung. Would you like to have a lung like that? No, because even though you have air in there, you can't get it out, so that means you can't take another breath. So that's going to get really old in a hurry, right? You're going to feel really miserable. What about this balloon right here? Okay, would this maybe be a better example of an alveolus? Let's put some air in here. Hopefully it won't blow up. Okay, so that's a pretty good example of an alveolus. Oops, sorry. Okay, so it's inflated. Now if I let this go, okay, what's going to happen to the shape of that alveolus? Dang, I didn't let you guys have a chance to tell me. What's going to happen to that alveolus? It's going to collapse because of why? The elasticity of the rubber band. So what's a better functioning model of an alveolus? It's a balloon because it has functioning elastic fibers. Okay, so there are conditions when people lose elasticity of their lungs, right? And that's a terrible circumstance. I don't know of any way to restore it. And a nice, normal, healthy lung has a lot of elastic tissue. All right, so if you have nice, healthy lungs that resemble this balloon like this, do you think maybe it's a good idea to pollute your lung with really hazardous, harmful chemicals like cigarette smoke, or even more harmful materials like marijuana smoke or cocaine and things like that? Guess what's happening to your pulmonary function? You're killing your pulmonary function when you do that. Okay, so just kind of be aware of that. All right. let's see what we can say about compliance right here. So don't forget about that elastic. We're going to talk some more about those elastic properties of the alveoli later on too. Actually, we talked about compliance already, It just says, how does the lung change its volume when there is a change in pressure, right? And in the healthy lung, the lung is very compliant. And elasticity is very important too, all right? And we talked about surface tension already. Let's see if there's anything else I need to say about surface tension. Not really. I don't need to talk anything more about that. And you know what? I'm not going to test you on the law of Laplace. Okay, so you can forget this slide right here. All right, but you should, nonetheless, understand what the surfactant is doing. Okay, it's lining the alveolus, and we can see it right here. You should know what kind of cell produces it, right? The alveolar type 2 cell, and it lowers the stickiness of water. All right, but and you only have them in an alveolus. You don't have them in the intrapulmonary space because you need that stickiness between the wall of the thorax and the surface of the lung. All right, and that does cause problems for some people, all right, when people don't produce surfactant. Surfactant secretion actually begins very late in fetal life, and so this is before you're born. And those type 2 cells really get stimulated when a fetus is under stress, under duress. All right, so, and what's a very stressful situation for an infant? For a fetus? When you're born, right? Parturition is very, very stressful. All right, and so that stress actually stimulates those type 2 cells into producing surfactant, and that allows the newborn, the neonate, to breathe right after delivery. Okay, but if somebody's born by cesarean section, that stress level is not the same. The type 2 cells aren't stimulated the same way, especially if it's a premature delivery. The type 2 cells aren't mature enough to secrete surfactant, so those infants are in respiratory distress. They can't inflate their lungs. So what do you do for somebody in that situation? You put them in an incubator, right, not only to help regulate their body temperature, all right, but that incubator is at a very high oxygen concentration, so that just helps them absorb oxygen from the air into their body, even though their lungs are not developed yet. Maybe the physical structures of their lungs are developed, but those type 2 cells aren't developed, and therefore they can't inflate alveoli.
I have a question.
Yeah.
For example, babies that are born that their weight is below the average that they should be. Like, for example, I was born that my weight was, a lot lower.
Yeah.
Why do you have to stay in the incubator for a certain amount of time? Is it because your lungs are smaller? Is it because of complications?
I might wake up with an answer in the morning to that one, but I don't have one on the top of my head. Okay? Critical care of neonates is a super specialty, and you have to consider a lot of things, and so I'm not sure I could consider all the things I need to consider to answer your question properly right at the moment, okay? So it's tricky, and they're some of the trickiest patients. You can lose them in just seconds or minutes if you don't treat them right, okay? So I can't give you a really quick answer to that, so let me think about it. And we can talk maybe after class or something.
It's not just the lungs itself.
It's not just the lungs themselves, right? Yeah. That might be the major consideration, but I have to think about it for a little bit, okay? Okay. Okay, so RDS is just respiratory distress syndrome due to not enough surfactant being secreted by the type 2 cells. And even adults, when they go into septic shock, right, that's called acute respiratory distress syndrome. That decreases compliance of the lungs as well as decreasing surfactant secretion, and that puts them right in respiratory distress. That's a difficult situation to treat as well. Okay, we talked a little bit about the mechanics of breathing, but let's talk in a little bit more detail. All right, so here we just have a nice plain X-ray, plain meaning just a flat, just as opposed to a three-dimensional kind of image of somebody's lungs, right? And we can look at the shape of the lungs and get an impression of what the volume of the lung is just by looking at its shape. And then we can have somebody inflate their lungs, take a breath, and take another x-ray, and just make a comparison of the size of the lung when the lung is deflated compared to when it is inflated. And can you see that there is a difference? The dotted line represents the shape of the lung when you're not breathing, when it's deflated. And here, this dark line right here just represents the shape of the lung, right, when after somebody has taken a deep breath. And this is probably a pretty much a maximal inspiration. All right, so you can see that the inferior dimension of the lungs increases dramatically, but what other dimension increases as well? The lateral dimension, so that the thoracic cavity not only gets larger inferiorly, but it gets larger laterally as well. And if we were to take an x-ray with a sagittal view, we would notice that the sternum actually moves anteriorly and superiorly as well. So the whole thoracic cavity expands anteriorly, laterally, and also inferiorly. All right, so the volume increases during inspiration. And as the volume increases, what happens to pressure inside the lungs? It decreases, right? And what law is that? That's Boyle's law, right? Okay, because volume and pressure are inversely related to each other. All right, so don't forget about that one. That's a good law to remember. All right, so there are actually two ways that we breathe. There is a way that you're breathing right now called quiet breathing. And there is a way that you hyperventilate when you're exercising, and we call that forced breathing. So the two modes of breathing, right, if we're going to think very analytically and critical about breathing, there's quiet breathing and forced breathing. Let me just see what your book calls it deep breathing. Deep breathing and forced breathing are the same kind of thing. So what kind of breathing are you doing right now? You're doing quiet breathing because you're not exercising. Okay. So there are some muscles that are necessary for inspiration, and primarily you should be aware that the one that's most important is the diaphragm. Okay, when the diaphragm contracts, it goes from this severely dome-shaped muscle to one that is very flat, like we saw in the previous picture. Right? So that dramatically increases the volume of the lung when that happens. And the lung is, the surface of the lung is attached to the diaphragm via the serous fluid, which is really, really sticky, right? So that increases the volume of the lung as well when the thoracic cavity expands. Okay. So inspiration occurs mainly because the diaphragm contracts, increasing the thoracic volume. But there are some other muscles that might be used, parasternal muscles, right, that we see right up over here, and also external intercostals. The external and parasternals elevate the rib cage, right? So the diaphragm depresses, enlarges the thoracic volume. The external intercostals raise the rib cage laterally and also anteriorly that we saw on those x-rays. All right, so that's in quiet breathing. And expiration for quiet breathing doesn't require any muscles to contract at all. For expiration, all one has to do, if you have a healthy lung, is to relax the external intercostals and relax the diaphragm. And because of all the elastic properties of muscle and around the alveoli, right, that decreases the volume of the thoracic cavity, increasing the pressure that forces air out of your lungs. So what's interesting that you should know is that for quiet breathing, think in terms of active versus passive processes. Inspiration is what kind of process, active or passive? It's active, requires muscles to contract. What about expiration in a healthy lung? Is passive, it just requires that all the elastic properties function. You don't need muscles to exhale in the condition that you're in right now because it is a passive process. For forced breathing, on the other hand, or deep breathing, when you need to move a lot more air in and out of your lungs, inspiration involves contraction of extra muscles to elevate the ribs maximally, like the scalenes and the sternocleidomastoid, pectoralis minor muscle, will elevate the ribs and will accentuate the expansion of the rib cage. All right, so not just the diaphragm, but some of these auxiliary muscles. And you might notice that people that have trouble breathing, like people with emphysema, these muscles are very big and powerful because they exercise them, what, all day long, right? And so somebody with emphysema just has a typical barrel-chested shape because of those additional muscles that are necessary for inspiration. All right, for hyperventilation or deep breathing, expiration is no longer a passive process because the elastic properties can't move the amount of air out of the lungs that's necessary. So there are some other muscles then that are recruited, namely the internal intercostals, which pull the ribs down, right, decreasing the thoracic volume, as well as all of the abdominal muscles, the rectus abdominis, the transverse, the oblique, right, internal and external abdominal muscles, because when they contract, they compress all of the abdominal contents, it forces it up into the thoracic cavity, and that sort of acts like a plunger forcing air out of your lungs. All right, so in terms of quiet breathing, which process is active in quiet breathing? Inspiration. Which one is passive? Expiration. Now for deep breathing or forced breathing, which one is active? Both inspiration and expiration require muscles for that to happen. Inspiration and expiration for deep breathing is never a passive process, requires muscles. All right. So that's a good thing to remember. I don't know why you have two slides. We only need this one right here. Did you guys actually print out two?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Okay. We only need this one right here. All right, so at rest, remember, fluid moves only due to a pressure difference, right? Just like diffusion moves by a concentration difference. And when the concentration of a solute is the same in two locations, what happens to diffusion? It stops. If the pressure in two locations is the same, what happens to the motion of a fluid? It stops, right? So at rest, the intrapulmonary pressure is 760 millimeters of mercury, and the atmospheric pressure is 760 millimeters of mercury. Which way is air going to move? Okay. If the intrapulmonary is 760 and the atmospheric is 760, which way is air going to move? It's not going to move because there is what? No pressure difference. So air is not going to move. You're neither inhaling or exhaling at that point in time. All right, but if you contract the diaphragm and get those external intercostals to elevate the rib cage, that increases the volume, right, of the lungs. And as the volume increases, what happens to pressure? Remember Boyle's law, as the volume increases, the pressure goes from 760 to 754, it decreases, right? That's Boyle's law. All right, what about atmospheric pressure? Does that change during breathing? No, it stays the same. All right, so now you have the intrapulmonary pressure at 757, atmospheric is 760. Is there a difference in pressure there? Yeah, which one is lower, 760 or 757? The intrapulmonary pressure is lower by 3 millimeters of mercury, and that's plenty, right, for air to enter the lungs, okay, because the pressure is lower. And then on expiration, what happens? The diaphragm relaxes, the elastic properties of the lungs, right, collapse the lungs, and so the pressure goes up to 763. The intrapulmonary pressure is 763. What about atmospheric pressure? What's atmospheric pressure at this point? 760, so now the pressure inside your lungs is 3 millimeters of mercury greater, so air leaves your lungs as a result. Okay, so that's pretty much the mechanics of how we move air in and out of our lungs. And this is measured with something called a spirometer. Right? And a spirometer is actually a little exercise device that some people use after surgery, because I guess that pleural effusion is a complication of surgery where that pulmonary space fills up with fluid. Right? And so a spirometer is something that you can use to help exercise your muscles and the lung tissue while you're breathing, but it can also be used to measure the volumes of air that you're breathing. All right? And that's important after surgery, because your lung volume should always be increasing after surgery. If it starts to decrease, all right, that's a sort of coming back to me, that's a sign of what? Pleural effusion, that you have fluid building up in the intrapleural space. All right, so spirometry uses a spirometer. Do those electronic ones in lab work? Did you guys use those in lab? The spirometer? I don't think we could get those working. Did we have any mechanical ones? No? When you did your lung lab? Okay. Okay, those are the things that you just measure pulmonary volumes with. All right, so let's look. This is, in any physiology class that you ever take, like an A&P class, a really low-level A&P class, you learn something about these pulmonary volumes, and certainly in a human physiology class, you'll see this. You might see these kinds of spirometry tests, even on a board exam. All right, so this is just a really classical kind of exam, so I'm sure this is an exam figure, right? And it defines the volumes that we use to think about lung function. And the total lung capacity, all right, well, this is a plot of the volume versus time as maybe somebody's breathing, all right? So this is just volume versus time. And we have the total lung volume. What would be the total lung volume in an average person if we look at this graph right here? This is in, what, cubic centimeters? So 1,000 would be equal to 1 liter because there's 1,000 milliliters in 1 liter. What would be the typical lung volume in a healthy young person? If you can read this right here. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, let's just say liters, 5 liters. Not quite 6 liters, but a typical value would be about 5.7, 5.8 liters, something like that. That's your typical lung volume when you're nice and young. Unfortunately, what happens to your lung volume as you get older? It decreases, okay? And that decreases the amount of oxygen that you can get into your body, okay? So when you're just quiet breathing like you are right now, you're breathing air in and you're breathing air out, kind of like the tides in the ocean coming up and then going down on the beach. So this little change in lung volume right here is just due to quiet breathing. We call this the tidal volume. And notice that the tidal volume is not way down at the bottom of your lung volume or way up at the top. It's where? Kind of in the middle, right, of your lung volume. A little bit more toward the bottom than the exact middle, right, in a normal lung. And it's what? It's maybe about 500 ml, something like that, when you're not exercising, right? But at the end of a normal expiration, when you're breathing just quietly, you can force more air out of your lungs, right? So at the end of a normal expiration, you can do what? You can go really compress your chest, decrease the volume as much as possible. What happens to the pressure inside your lungs as you decrease the volume of your thoracic cavity? It goes way up, and that forces a lot of extra air out of the lungs. This is what we call the expiratory reserve volume. Okay? There's also a condition where at the top of a normal inspiration, what can you do? Maybe if you're a flute player or a trumpet player or something like that, you can take, or a singer, you can take an additional really deep breath and fill your lungs up maximally up to the maximal lung volume. And this right here is what we call the inspiratory reserve volume. Right? And so this volume, expiratory reserve, the tidal volume, and inspiratory reserve, those are the volumes that you can consciously control in your body. Right? Those are the ones that you can adjust depending on your physical activity. So sometimes, and this is the amount of air that you can actually move in and out of your lungs. If we add these volumes together, which is what? Inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve, and tidal volume, that's what we call a capacity, and in particular, the vital capacity. That's a pretty important measurement to know in people, vital capacity. That's the amount of air that you can actually, new air that you can get into your lungs for gas exchange. So a capacity is always going to be a combination of basic lung volumes, right? So you got to know the definition of vital capacity, which is easy to see on this diagram right here. The only other lung volume that we have is that even if you try as hard as you can to exhale all the air that's in your lungs, there's always going to be some left over because your upper respiratory tract has what in it that prevents its collapse completely?
Cartilage.
It has cartilage, like the trachea and bronchi have cartilage. So there's always going to be air trapped in those spaces and your lungs, right? And even the alveoli can't collapse completely. And that produces a volume that we call residual volume, okay? And so if we add the vital capacity with residual volume, that equals what? The total lung capacity, all right? So those are the capacities and the volumes that I'm most interested for you to know in here. Tidal volume, expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve, residual volume, the total lung volume, which is all those volumes added together, and even more importantly, the vital capacity is what? Just the inspiratory and expiratory reserve and the tidal volume. Okay, so this is a nice exam figure that you should be able to label. That's going to be really easy. Easy points on the test. Okay, and what kind of instruments do we use to measure these volumes with right here? The spirometer, yeah. So this is just spirometry in action. All right, so this table right here just basically describes what we have already talked about. So if you want to read over those things, you're welcome to do that. All right, let's talk about some factors that affect gas exchange. All right, we learned about Boyle's Law, which says that pressure and volume are related to each other. How are they related to each other? Inversely, that says it all, right? Okay, let's talk about another law. And it has to do with partial pressures. There are many compounds that come together to form air. And some of these compounds are nitrogen, and there's oxygen in the air, there's carbon dioxide, and there's even water vapor in the air. Not liquid, but when it evaporates, it becomes a gas. We call that water vapor. Right? The partial pressure is the pressure that a single gas or a particular gas in a mixture of gases exerts on the whole pressure of that volume, right? And Dalton's law states that the total pressure of a gas mixture, like the air that we're breathing right now, is just the sum of all the partial pressures of each of the gases in that mixture, all right? So atmospheric pressure in this particular case at sea level, which is basically what we're at, is around 760 millimeters of mercury. And what is that due to? That's due to a number of different chemical compounds that are in the air, namely nitrogen, oxygen, CO2, and water, right? So we need to find the partial pressure of each of these gases right here, add them up, and they've got to equal 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay. So let's take a look at some of these partial pressures of these various compounds. I don't know, what's the humidity today? Probably pretty low. It was really low yesterday. So the water partial pressure probably was zero. Right? And the partial pressure for CO2, what does that look like to you? 0.3 millimeters of mercury. Well, let's just look at oxygen. Oxygen is what? 159 millimeters of mercury. Nitrogen is the major component in air that we breathe. That's 601 millimeters of mercury. Nitrogen is completely inert in our body under most circumstances, doesn't play any role physiologically, okay? So most of the air that we're breathing is nitrogen, really has no effect on us. There's a lot of oxygen in air, but what about CO2? It's pretty close to zero, right? It's pretty close to zero. And that's pretty fortunate because our body produces CO2, and it's a toxic compound. And in order for that to leave your body, there has to be what? There has to be what? A concentration gradient. In order for CO2 to leave your body, right, just by diffusion, CO2 will leave because CO2 is about 40 millimeters of mercury inside your body, and in the air it's about zero. So CO2 leaves your body very efficiently as a result of that. Okay? Okay. And we're going to see the same thing for oxygen. Oxygen is very high concentration in the air, relatively low in your body. So which way does oxygen move? From the air into your body as a result. Okay. All right, so the gas exchange, maybe I can see some things right here, is facilitated by the enormous surface area of alveoli. Which is what? What's the surface area if you add up all those 300 million alveoli? 70 square meters, right? That's a huge doorway. All right, and also the respiratory membrane is extremely thin. Right, so the distance between air and the alveoli and the capillaries is very, very small. Right, and the density of capillaries around an alveolus is huge. Right, so every alveolus is surrounded by an extreme, tremendous network of capillaries. Okay. The rate of blood flow through the pulmonary circuit has to equal the rate of blood flow through the systemic circuit. So when you look at the heart, if you think of the heart as an organ, how many do you have? How many hearts do you have? How many hearts do you have? Okay, how many valves do you have?
Four.
How many chambers do you have? Okay, that's good. So you got one heart made up of all those chambers. Okay. But if you look at the heart functionally, even though you have one, okay, how many sides of the heart do you have? You really have two sides. You've got the left side and you've got the right side. Right? So actually, you have two hearts, but they're just kind of melded together by the interventricular septum. So the left side of the heart pumps blood through the systemic circulation, and the right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. So a better way of thinking about the heart is that you actually have two of them pumping blood into two different circuits. Okay, so let me see if I can draw this diagram. All right, like half a heart kind of looks something like this right here, and that half a heart is going to pump blood through the pulmonary circulation, all right, and then it's going to go back to what? The left side of the heart. And the left side of the heart is going to pump blood through the systemic circulation back to the right atrium, like that. All right, so you have two hearts functionally right there. Now, what about the amount of blood flowing through the pulmonary circulation compared to the systemic circulation? What's the relationship there? It should be the same. Because what were to happen if more blood was pumped by the systemic circulation than the pulmonary circulation? If the pulmonary circulation was a little bit slow, wasn't pumping the same amount of blood, what would happen to it? It would start to back up over here. Right? And so this side would fill up with blood, right? Because the pulmonary circuit wasn't having the right amount of blood flow to it. It would fill up, and I guess it would burst like a balloon or something, and there'd be blood all over the place. So that wouldn't happen. Right? So the flow through the pulmonary circulation and the systemic circulation have to be matched. And one thing that does that is the Frank Starling law of the heart, right? If the systemic circulation returns more blood to the right ventricle fills a little bit more, what does it do? It contracts a little bit harder to pump that blood through the pulmonary circulation, right? So it automatically adjusts each other because of that intrinsic property of the heart. Okay, so they have to be matched up. All right, but what about the resistance in these blood vessels? The resistance of the systemic circulation is a lot higher because there are many more blood vessels. Blood has to travel a longer distance. Remember, because of Poiseuille's law, as the length of a blood vessel increases, what happens to resistance? It increases. And to get the same blood flow, what moves blood from one place to another? A pressure. So if there's more resistance, what can you tell me about the pressure in the systemic circulation? It has to be higher than the pulmonary circulation, which has relatively low resistance. Doesn't take the same amount of pressure gradient to get the same blood flow through here. All right, so the pulmonary circulation is only about 15 millimeters of mercury on average. Right, it's really, really low. And that's kind of helpful because the low pressure in the capillaries means that it forces less fluid out of the capillaries. Remember, fluid leaves capillaries. Remember the different kinds of capillaries you have? like the continuous and fenestrated and the sinusoids. So fluid leaves capillaries, but because the pressure is so low in the lungs, very little fluid leaves and goes into the tissue spaces. And that's really good because you don't want fluid in your lungs. We would call that pulmonary edema. All right, so that aids the lung function just by having a lower pressure right there. All right. The pulmonary arterioles. Remember, arterioles have a lot of smooth muscle around them. So they can vasoconstrict or they can vasodilate. What happens to blood flow when an arteriole vasoconstricts? Does it decrease or increase? It decreases. And is it dramatic or just kind of, is it a dramatic decrease or is it just kind of maybe an unexpected, usual kind of decrease? If there's vasoconstriction, it is a dramatic decrease because, again, of Poiseuille's law. Because the blood flow changes by the change in radius by what? A factor of 4, the fourth power rule. Okay. All right, so pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2, so this is the concentration, the partial pressure of oxygen in the alveolus, is low and dilates where it is high. And so that's opposite compared to the systemic circulation. So let's compare the systemic circulation first. So we have the heart right here pumping blood out. So what do we call this kind of vessel right here? Artery. Artery is going to go to a capillary, right? A capillary. And then to a vein right here. Okay. And blood flow through this capillary, remember in anatomy, there's something that kind of guards the entrance to these capillaries. There are circular smooth muscles right here. What do we call these things? The precapillary sphincters, right? Precapillary sphincters. And just like the heart has intrinsic control, as the heart gets more blood to pump, it gets stronger because of end-diastolic volume going up. All right. If we have a muscle right here, so here's a sarcomere, and let's just say it's completely contracted. All right, so we got actin and myosin filaments, and it can't contract anymore. What's necessary for this sarcomere to contract? What's it using up? ATP. Okay, it's using up ATP, and it's going to ADP, and mitochondria are going to be trying to make a lot of ATP, but since that muscle's contracted, oxygen isn't getting to it, right, because it's contracted. So what metabolic pathway is working? Is it aerobic or anaerobic? Aerobic or anaerobic, when muscles contract strenuously? I know you guys didn't think you had to remember anything about respiration. Anaerobic. What's the last product in anaerobic respiration? Lactic acid, right? So lactic acid is formed, right? So one of the key terms right here is acid. This compound leaves the muscle, right, the skeletal muscle that is contracting, and it influences these precapillary sphincters. So lactic acid goes to these precapillary sphincters. And what might be a good thing, what might be a really good effect on these precapillary sphincters when an exercising muscle is producing lactic acid and ADP, signs that the tissue is working really hard? What does a tissue need when it's working really hard? Oxygen and glucose. How do you get oxygen and glucose? From the blood right here. So what would happen to these precapillary sphincters, would you think? They should relax. They should dilate. They should get really big, allowing perfusion of this tissue so that it can get oxygen and nutrients to, right, maintain contraction. So that's in the systemic circulation. Right? That's what we call local control. Does that kind of make sense? That the products of metabolism of the cell regulate blood flow, and as the metabolism increases, you need more blood flow, so the precapillary sphincters relax. That allows that tissue to be perfused. That's systemic circulation. But that's not what we're talking about in this chapter. What are we talking about in this chapter? the pulmonary circulation. And in usual, when you think of pulmonary circulation and compare it to systemic circulation, functionally, how do they relate to each other? Are they the same? And so let me ask you another kind of question. In the systemic circulation that we have right here, what kind of blood is in this artery? Is this oxygenated or deoxygenated? It's oxygenated. What about the state of oxygenation in this pulmonary artery? Is it oxygenated or deoxygenated? It's deoxygenated. So in terms of these two arteries right here, functionally, how would you think of them? They're opposite each other, right? They're kind of opposite each other. Well, in terms of vasodilation, guess what? The pulmonary circulation is the opposite as well compared to the systemic circulation. So if there is low oxygen in this tissue, if it's a systemic circulation, if there's low oxygen, that's going to produce vasodilation. But in the pulmonary circulation, if there's low oxygen in the alveolus, guess what it causes? Vasoconstriction. And we got time for me to tell you why that makes sense. Okay? So why does that make sense? Because why is blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? And if there is no oxygen in a certain part of your lung, why do you want to have blood to go to that part of the lung? Because there's no oxygen there to be picked up. So if there's no oxygen, the pulmonary circulation vasoconstricts and blood doesn't go to that part of the lung that doesn't have oxygen. Where does it go? To another part of the lung that does have oxygen, because what's the function of the pulmonary circulation? To pick up oxygen. So oxygen, high oxygen concentration in the alveolus causes vasodilation because blood is going there to pick up oxygen. In the systemic circulation, high oxygen causes vasoconstriction because those tissues don't need oxygen because it's high already. All right, so again, just kind of think of pulmonary circulation as being what compared to the systemic? Opposite each other. All right, it's that way in terms of oxygen concentration in the arteries and veins as well as how blood flow is regulated. So, then that term is what we call matching ventilation with perfusion. Perfusion is blood flow going to a part of the lung, right? That automatically adjusts itself so blood goes to the part of the lung that has oxygen and it doesn't go to another part of the lung that is low in oxygen because that wouldn't help you. So it's got to be opposite compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so I think I like my discussion more than talking about this slide right here. All right, so I guess next week we're going to start here with control of ventilation. You might have to remind me where to start. Okay, sign-in sheet was going around somewhere. Who's got the sign-in sheet? All the way up on the top.